Here's a quick thanks to our sponsors. Mofo, male optimization formula with organs to boost testosterone. ButcherBox, convenient, affordable, free delivery of the highest quality meat, poultry, and seafood. Buy Optimizers, performance supplements like magnesium, probiotics, and more. Beauty Counter, a complete line of safer skincare and cosmetic products. B-Rad Grass-Fed Whey Protein Isolate Super Fuel, the ultimate performance recovery and longevity drink. And Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece, mind-blowing nut butter blend. And check out the favorites link at bradkearns.com for my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance, and great discounts for listeners. And here we go with the show.
You know, like, great that I can push a button and get a pizza delivered and watch a video game. But I think what people don't realize is what the hidden biological costs are. It didn't shine and sparkle the way that we thought it would. And we put it on our shelves and it's getting dull, and now we might even throw it away. The body is a powerful instrument and we often forget about it.
It's time to change your life first thing in the morning. You've probably heard me talk with extreme enthusiasm about my morning exercise routine, which has progressed from a modest start 5 years ago into an elaborate 40-minute sequence that provides a total body workout and lays an incredible foundation for a focused, productive, active day. Oh my gosh, I've been athletic all my life, and of course my workouts have been a centerpiece, but this is different. It has shaped my entire approach to fitness to get up and do the exact same thing every day in a habitual manner. It shapes my focus and discipline with my work endeavors throughout the day, and it has been a major catalyst to losing excess body fat and keeping it off. I want to share my passion and guidance with you through an online multimedia educational course called The Comprehensive Guide to Developing the Ultimate Morning Exercise Routine. You'll learn how to custom design a morning routine that's convenient, enjoyable, and sustainable for you, and learn to reliably integrate your morning exercises into habit so you don't have to summon motivation, willpower, or creativity. You just hit the deck and get going. It becomes an automatic behavior with no excuses or distractions. The routine will indeed be life-changing because it establishes focus, discipline, and resilience that carry over into all areas of hectic, high-stress modern life. The course portal comes with extensive video education, a 50-page ebook and follow-along recording audio, and bonus ebooks. You will quickly learn 3 different routine options with dozens of different exercises, everything totally scalable to your level of fitness and time available in the morning. You'll learn the health and circadian benefits of habitual morning exercise and the logistics of how to design a custom program and progress gracefully over time. Please visit bradkearns.com to learn more about the program and enroll today. You get instant access, lifetime access to all the materials. Use the code BRAD10, B-R-A-D-10, for a 10% discount. It's time to make a commitment to yourself and your fitness and start your day the right way. Listeners, get ready for a powerful, impactful, thought-provoking show with Dr. Anna Lemke. She is the author of the sensational best-selling book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. And I loved how this conversation just flowed very breezily and comfortably through a variety of topics, especially starting out talking about athletes and how the nature of addiction can permeate even what seemingly to be the healthy, fit population, but especially how, you know, we're all now in this game, we're all vulnerable to all manner of dopamine-seeking temptations, dopamine-triggering temptations of modern life. Here's a quote from Dr. Lemke to tee this up. Because we've transformed the world from a place of scarcity, that means the survival of the fittest, right? Our ancestral life where we had to go and hunt and gather and fight for our lives, essentially. Today, instead of a place of scarcity, it's a place of overwhelming abundance. Drugs, food, news, gambling, shopping, gaming, texting, sexting, Facebooking, Instagramming, YouTubing, tweeting, the increased numbers, variety, and potency of highly rewarding stimuli today is staggering. The smartphone is the modern-day hypodermic needle delivering digital dopamine 24/7 for a wired generation. Dr. Lemke is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University Medical School and chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. In the book, she talks quite a bit about her patients that had these extreme and shocking addictions and how they processed through that. But rather than seeing myself as separate from someone who might be considered a more extreme addict, I realized that all of us every day are in this highly vulnerable situation thanks to the inexorable progress of society and technology to where everything is easy and we can get instant gratification all day long. So you're going to learn about the importance of achieving this neurochemical balance in the brain, inducing appropriate amounts of pain, discomfort, challenge, and that could be working hard physically or cognitively, and that will help the brain rebalance and keep you out of that trap of downward spiral into addiction from excessive dopamine-seeking, pleasure-seeking, instant gratification behavior. You're really going to enjoy this conversation. I highly encourage you to pick up the book. There's so many great tips in there at whatever level you're striving to improve as a person, especially this recommendation that a detox process lasting at least 30 days can be the secret to rebalancing and getting out of even those what you might consider minor or annoying little proclivities that we have for thrill-seeking behavior that are out of balance and result in a net adverse overall experience. So let's hear it from Dr. Anna. Here we go. Dr. Anna, I'm so happy to catch up with you. We have important things to talk about. I have an opening line for you. You ready?
Yes.
I was going to say that I was incredibly excited to talk to you, but I don't want to get too excited. I don't want to get those those neurochemicals out of balance. Okay, there we go. But I am very excited. And your book, Dopamine Nation, subtitle, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence, pretty much identifies a major problem of society today.
Yes, it does. And I appreciate your wanting to start off without getting too out of balance, which does raise, you know, an interesting philosophical question about, should we let ourselves get excited about things? Should we be throwing these great big birthday parties, you know, for our kids? Or is that also part of the problem? So I like that you started out there.
Well, what do you think? I've reflected on times in my life where, you know, the highs and lows were more extreme. I used to be an athlete, so I raced on the professional triathlon circuit for 9 years, and everything was all about the next big race. And oh my gosh, it's so melodramatic. If I have a bad race, my life is terrible. And then if I win, I'm on the cover of the magazine. Whoop-de-doo. Hey, there it is in the background. 30 years later, it's still on my wall. Whoop-de-doo. But you know, you move into different phases of life. I think maturity is great. And one of the best things about getting older is a little more perspective where, you know, what we do is not the end of the world, and the sun will rise another day.
Well, so I find this really fascinating. And to my surprise, one of the big audiences for my book, Dopamine Nation, has actually been athletes, especially elite athletes. So I'm really, you know, and as you know, in my book, one of the things I do recommend is actually intentionally inviting pain into our lives as an indirect source of dopamine, which I claim, based on the, you know, neuroscience, is less vulnerable to this problem of addiction because we're less likely to get tolerant to it. But having said that, clearly people can get addicted to various forms of pain. People can get addicted to exercise and just striving in general. So I'm very curious, as you look back on your triathlon career and the kind of striving cycle that you were in, I mean, do you regret that time, or do you feel like it was, I mean, would you do it differently looking back? What do you think?
Definitely. The main difference would be
to have a kinder, gentler approach, which is what I promote now about fitness, because I think we were socialized inaccurately to think that no pain, no gain is the essence of being a competitor. And so I think you learn through struggle, failure, disappointment, these valuable lessons where you keep a little more of a level head. And I think that the physical exertion should be balanced better. But you're probably asking about, you know, my mindset and all that. And I think, you know, the focus on the process or the emphasis on the process, which comes out of your work wonderfully. And I wrote down some great quotes about this. I think that's where the magic is where you're waking up every day. You have a passion, you have excitement, you're striving, but the result is sort of a consequence rather than the obsession. And I think that's where we get into trouble is when we're obsessed with, I guess, pleasure seeking. That's where we head down the path of addiction and disappointment and things of that nature.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So one of the big problems that I see in the world today is that we've drugified even healthy and adaptive behaviors. And one of the ways in which sports has surely become drugified is not just through like the various types of equipment that allow us to push ourselves to unprecedented extremes, but also really important through the rankings and the social media and the ways in which now it becomes about the time or the ranking. And the competitive pool is just so much greater. I mean, in ways that I find really interesting, the Olympics has sort of lost some of its salience because it was the one place before that you had people from all over the world kind of coming together and competing against each other. But now that's happening all the time, right? Mm. Millions of people over the world through social media ranking themselves, and even high schoolers, you know, even elementary school age athletes kind of being ranked on a national level and that contributing. So that's what I mean. It's like the bad part is the chasing the dopamine part. And what is dopamine sensitive to? It's sensitive to things like enumeration when we give something a number. So like the digital likes or the rankings on video games, or for that matter, the times and the ranking on sports and the quantification of our behavior, I think it's a big piece of how we've sort of drugified these things that make it harder to focus on process.
That's pretty much the essence of the problem I see with sports all the way down to youth. And I went through that journey with my kids, and you know, it was nauseating to have this overpressurized, parental driven competitive experience, obsession with winning and ranking. Yes. And so I guess in contrast, a healthy approach would be bringing in these other neurochemicals like serotonin, oxytocin, the satisfaction, fulfillment, long-term bonding with others. Is that what we're shooting for?
Yeah. And I think especially with athletes, you know, really de-emphasizing the identity piece as like, I'm this, you know, star baseball player, or I'm the person who's going to get recruited to X, Y, or Z division school, and really allowing young people to develop a grounding of their identity in things that are transcendent, you know, not the things that are tied to these kind of material competitive pieces. Of course, we all love sports and the excellence of sports and the human body and achievement. So it's not that we're throwing it out the window, but if that's all that the person has and there's no sort of girding of that or scaffold beneath that, then you're really, you know, setting people up for a very serious fall.
Yeah. And I think we've been kind of brainwashed to misunderstand this as the adoring public obsessing with our teams winning and filling the stadiums. But it really is an ill-advised path, even for the elite athletes of the world. And we've seen, oh my gosh, talk about hitting close to home, the tragic story of the Stanford goalkeeper and other athletes that are, you know, they can't, they succumb to the pressure. We're talking about the suicide cases in collegiate athletes. Right. And then even at the elite levels, when they go and win everything, then they go crash their Rolls Royce at 3 a.m. And they can't even adjust to real life, even as they have all the accolades and all the success.
Right. Or even, you know, with less dramatic kind of, you know, tragic endings, you've just got like, you know, that gold medal winner who's sacrificed so much of their life. And then they're like, but what do I, what now? You know, what
right. Yeah. The Weight of Gold, the documentary featuring Michael Phelps and talking about a lot of them is there's no place to go from the pinnacle of there will never be another dopamine rush to like match that. Winning the gold.
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, and, you know, the other thing about sports is that, you know, it's not just the athlete who then finds themselves caught in this dopamine vortex, but it's the gaping maw of spectators who are basically their source of dopamine hits. And maybe it involves them gambling on athletes in addition, but it doesn't even have to be that. But the kind of consumption of sports as a spectator is very much vulnerable to this problem of addiction.
Oh boy. And addiction is really your central focus of the book. I really appreciate how you presented everything, including bringing your personal story in. And it occurred to me as I'm reading kind of the extreme cases of addiction that we're all familiar with. And the homeless encampment down by the river, those people are all addicts. And I'm driving by thinking that I'm immune from all this stuff. But I think we all need to sit back and reflect and realize that at some level, the addiction is profound in society, especially with, here's your quote. The smartphone is the modern day hypodermic needle delivering digital dopamine 24/7 for a wired generation. So the desire to be free from that is a daily and constant challenge for everyone.
Boy, that's for sure. And, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that addiction is a spectrum disorder. And of course, you know, people with severe life-threatening addictions, that is different than what I talk about in, you know, the book as my kind of romance novel reading addiction.
All right. I should have identified.
She liked to read a lot of
romance novels, people. If you're watching on YouTube, you could probably see my addiction in the background, which is the dark chocolate wrap here. And I'm reflecting as I'm running out and I realized, shoot, I'm running out and maybe I should leave the rack empty for a few days just to prove that, you know, I can be resilient here. Okay. Excuse me.
No, it's great. And I think, you know, the point that I'm trying to make in the book is that, you know, wherever we fall on that spectrum of compulsive overconsumption to extreme life-threatening addiction, the point is that we all have the same mental circuitry that gets us to instinctively approach pleasure and avoid pain. And that, you know, ancient wiring is great for a world of scarcity because it makes us constant strivers, never satisfied with what we have, always wanting more. But it's incredibly pernicious in a world of overwhelming overabundance, which is the world we live in now, in which, you know, even previously healthy and adaptive behaviors like sports, like we've been talking about, have now become drugified and turned into, you know, the prospect of essentially chasing dopamine separate from the original meaning or purpose of that activity.
Right. The original, originally an adaptive behavior. And I'm remembering Baron Pierre de Coubertin, the founder of the modern Olympics, who said the important thing is not to win, but to take part. The Olympic oath goes on and on. It's like, are you kidding? We have trashed that thing because NBC just paid $877 million for the rights. Right. And so we want to see especially the red, white, and blue athletes win, but the whole thing's become marginalized, commercialized. Same with, I think, the fitness industry, diet, health, the areas that I traffic in, is everything's been, you know, branded and put a price tag on.
Right. And that's a really important point, that not only do things become potentially more addictive when we enumerate them or quantify them, because dopamine is very sensitive to numbers, but also when we monetize things, you know, in our capitalist system, anything that becomes monetized, then, you know, we're, our sort of striving mechanism, you know, kicks in, and then this can become, you know, which is why sort of workaholism is a real problem today.
So we don't want to tiptoe over that edge, and then you know, how do we negotiate or navigate this route if we want to achieve tenure in a university system? We have to be counting things, and the business experts that that try to rein me in want to see my spreadsheets. I'm like, oh yeah, spreadsheets. That's on my to-do list, I promise. Right. So we don't want to trend too far in the other direction where we're the easy breezy surfer dude. Although I think those people have a lot of secrets that the rest of us deserve to be to be unlocked. But how do we navigate that balance of existing in competitive modern culture?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it is a balance, right? It's a dynamic interaction between ourselves and the environment. And I think the key is really to not, you know, go too far in one direction or the other, but to try to really strive to find, you know, this balance between pain and pleasure, between consumption and abstinence, depending also on our own unique physiologic makeup, because people are going to come out at different places on that.
It occurs to me that in years, decades, generations past, we probably did that really well. We did a hard day's work at the factory. We came home, we sat down, that maybe it was a home cooked meal, so you had to put even a little more effort in. And then you sat by the radio and listened to the show as your entertainment. It seems now we have this tremendous ability to hijack, as Dr. Robert Lustig says in the title of his book, the hijack or the hacking of the American mind. We can hijack these long routes and now click a button and DoorDash comes rather than having to chop any vegetables. And that was my most benign example I could think of. But of course, we also have my former podcast guest John Gray talks about the evil combination of video games and porn for the young today's modern male, because they can hijack their two most profound inner biological drives just by sitting in front of a screen.
Right. Yes, exactly. And I think the key for people to understand who might be, you know, listening and think, well, who cares? I mean, that's fine. I mean, you know, like, great that I can push a button and get a pizza delivered and watch a video game. But I think what people don't realize is what the hidden biological costs are. And then those biological costs have, you know, very tangible repercussions in our lives. And what by that, I mean that, you know, our brain is fundamentally wired to preserve homeostasis, or kind of a level balance of dopamine firing. And by bombarding our brain's reward circuitry with this fire hose of dopamine from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed again, what the brain has to do to adapt to that is essentially downregulate our own dopamine production and transmission. That puts us into a dopamine deficit state. That is, we get to a point where our dopamine firing is actually below baseline. And that is very akin to a clinical depression. So, you know, the universal symptoms of withdrawal, which is what we're experiencing in that dopamine deficit state, are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and craving. So the bottom line is that paradoxically, this relentless pursuit of pleasure and obtaining of pleasure in a world that's made these reinforcers so accessible is that we ultimately end up more miserable, you know, more unhappy, less able to actually experience any pleasure at all. And I think that's kind of the message that I'm trying to convey, you know, in dopamine, that there are really physiologic costs to this, and they're incremental and they accumulate over time. And you know, they can get us to a very dark place.
So if we wanted to kind of try to regain balance, we have this thing. It's not your term. I think you call it the opponent process reaction, right? It's a scientific term. Okay, right. So this is where you mentioned briefly before, if we go out there and do that silly stuff like jump into my chest freezer or do a challenging hike or sit down and try to type a paper, we put ourselves into discomfort of either physical or, I guess, a cognitive challenge could count too, perhaps.
Yeah.
And we get this opponent process reaction.
Yeah. So I think, you know, what I use in the book is an extended metaphor of a balance, like a beam on a central fulcrum, which is like a teeter totter in a kid's playground, which represents how our brains process pleasure and pain, because pleasure and pain are co-located in the brain. The same parts of the brain that process pleasure also process pain, and they work like opposite sides of balance. So when we do something that's pleasurable or reinforcing, our balance tilts to the side of pleasure, But one of the overarching rules governing this balance, again, is that it wants to restore a level position, or what neuroscientists call homeostasis. And it does that by adapting to that stimulant or that intoxicant by downregulating our own dopamine production and transmission. And I imagine that as these neuroadaptation gremlins hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again. But they like it on the balance, so they stay on until it's tilted an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. That's the come down, the opponent process mechanism, the after effect. And then ultimately they get off maybe after a few seconds or minutes or hours or days. And then we're at the level balance again. But if we continue to bombard our reward pathway with highly reinforcing drugs and behaviors, we accumulate more and more gremlins on the side of the balance. And ultimately they're camped out there and we're now walking around with a balance tilted to the side of pain. We're in a chronic dopamine deficit state. Now we need to use our drug not to get high, just to feel normal. And when we're not using it, we're experiencing these universal symptoms of withdrawal. So with enough abstinence from our drug and enough brain plasticity, you know, those gremlins will eventually hop off and homeostasis is restored, which is why I recommend dopamine fasting. But the other thing that I recommend is actually intentionally pressing on the pain side of the balance, because the gremlins are agnostic to whatever the initial stimulus is. If we press first on the pleasure side by using an intoxicant, they will jump on the pain side. But if we press on the pain side, for example, by exercising, doing an ice cold water bath, doing something cognitively challenging, emotionally challenging, something that requires our strong focus and attention, anything that's difficult, then those gremlins will hop on the pleasure side of the balance and will actually trigger our body's own homeostatic healing mechanisms. We'll start to upregulate serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. And that's really a much better way to, you know, get our dopamine, as long as we don't overdo it, as we talked about in the beginning. Pressing too hard and too fast on the pain side of the balance actually turns that into an intoxicant. So that's really the idea, you know, how to find balance is that if we're going to press on the pleasure side, we need to do it not very often, to leave enough time in between for those gremlins to hop off and for homeostasis to be restored. And that ultimately a better way to get our dopamine is actually gentle presses on the pain side of the balance so that we reset our hedonic or pleasure set point to the side of pleasure.
Right. Appropriate introduction of pain, challenge, discomfort, struggle.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
And when you say drug this and drug that, I'm assuming the reaching for the smartphone could be in the same category as actually taking a drug when it comes to that addiction.
Yes, absolutely. So what's amazing about screens, including obviously our smartphone screen, is that the screens itself are reinforcing. So it's not just that they're a portal to highly reinforcing behaviors and actual substances that we can get delivered, but the medium itself is reinforcing. You know, the screen, the flashing light is sort of like a primitive fire. I think the kind of tapping on the phone sort of keys into our sort of, you know, micro movements that we probably evolved over millions of years, whether it's grinding weed or picking berries. You know, we have this sensation of actually accomplishing something with this little device, when in fact, you know, we may not be accomplishing anything at all with the time and energy spent, but we have the feeling of doing something important.
Wow. Those primitive comparisons. We never thought about that. Or they say smoking, a lot of the habit is the manual act of bringing something, you know, using your hands. So I guess the phone counts in there too.
Yeah. Especially since most of us live such disembodied lives now, where we're really spending all of our time and energy in our heads and very little time in our bodies. People are generally not very well acquainted with their bodies, you know, with the exception of athletes, of course. But even some athletes, you know, tune out signals, right? Don't listen to their bodies in the way that they should. So I think, you know, this disembodied nature is part of what makes these digital drugs so appealing. I mean, if you think about like video game avatars, these are very physical avatars. People are jumping and running and doing cartwheels. While the actual person is really just sitting for hours and hours, you know, in their chair. So there's a clear need to be embodied, and yet we're sort of denying that need. And I think it's leading to quite a lot of psychopathology.
Yeah, I'm particularly, I guess, sensitive to these things because I'm in that age group. I don't know about you listeners or Dr. Rana, but I've had this reference point of half of my life or whatever it was before even the internet fired up. And certainly the mobile devices have only been around for the last generation. And I have all these reflections and memories of going to the bookstore on a Saturday afternoon and you know, reading for an hour from this book and an hour from that book and bringing a stack home. And now, I'm embarrassed to say, like, I'm too busy to sit down and read very much. I hit Audible pretty hard, but most of that Audible because of going at 1.75 to 2.0 speed instead of 1.0 speed. How can I stand to be at 1.0 speed when I can push this button and read more books? Right. So yeah. It's kind of tough to juxtapose all that time in the natural world, my childhood. Of course, we can all reference the childhoods where we were running around outside and then came in for dinner. And so, you know, it's a heavy heart when I'm thinking about these problems and looking at the life that my kids face, who are both in their 20s now and have been brought up with the technology world.
Yeah, I mean, I think we really underestimate the merits of just slowing things down. We really have this illusion that speed is of the essence, and that the more that we do in any given unit in time, the more we'll get, and the more we'll get what we're the happier we'll be. And yet, of course, we've all experienced that we get to where we wanted to get, and it was not what we thought it would be. And there's this kind of deflation and disappointment, and physiologically, truly a kind of dopamine free fall. So I think this it's so important that we sort of, and in fact, the intentional slowing down in the moment of what we were doing and trying to do it more slowly, which is so paradoxical and so countercultural, can actually help us be more present in the moment and tap into process, which, as we were talking about in the beginning, is so important. Like, to how can we get to that place where we're in our bodies, in the moment, engaged in process, and not constantly feeling like we're missing out, or that if only we were further along, or if only I had already arrived at this place that I'm going to.
That comment reminds me of your epic life-changing quote. I've been thinking about it every day since I heard it, I think on another show a couple months ago. And it was if you can guess it, I'll give you $2, but it was, I think it really represents the secret to life. Are you ready?
Yeah.
You said the routine things that you do in daily life can take on epic proportions, but it doesn't mean you have to get to the top of the mountain. It reminds me also of Martin Luther King's famous quote about the street sweeper. Maybe people are familiar with that. He says, if one is to be a street sweeper, resolve to be the greatest street sweeper that the world has ever known, where everyone who passes by say, there goes the greatest, cleanest street ever, that kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
And that resonates so beautifully with me because, like I referenced back in my athletic times, it's like now literally the sum total of that entire decade on earth is in a manila folder in the back of my file cabinet where it has the result of every race. Yeah. But I lived and breathed every single one of those pieces of paper that slotted into a file folder in the back of my file cabinet.
Yeah.
And so at the time, like, it is okay for things to take on epic proportions, but the result is now in the folder. It's inconsequential to anything. It's all about the journey. And I think the sooner we figure that out, especially you young listeners out there, if you're feeling that pressure from the outside world, I'm always trying to be the counter motivational parent where I say, hey, don't worry. You know, there's enough U.S. senators. There's two from each state. That equals 100. You don't have to, answer to anyone but your own, your own calling, really.
Yes. You know, thank you for this message. It's so important for people young and old, myself included. You know, I think we all want to feel that our lives matter. We all want to feel that, right? We want to feel that there's a reason that we're here, that we're making some kind of positive difference, that our life has value. And yet so much of the way that we strive to get to that place, that feeling that our lives matter, or the conviction that it's true, is so orthogonal to the things that will actually, you know, give us that feeling. And you and I have, you know, through hindsight, the ability to know that, like, we have achieved the thing, right? And we looked at it and it was hollow and it didn't have, it didn't shine and sparkle the way that we thought it would. And we put it on our shelves and it's getting dull and now we might even throw it away. So how is it that we can convey to young people, you know, what this essence is? And I really think, you know, it's encouraging young people to, yes, don't try to find the grandiose thing that you need to do, but instead look at your life as it is and the opportunities, even in your life, whatever hand you've been dealt, to make a positive difference every day in a small way that may never get recognized by anybody else, but that has meaning for you, right? And it might be something like you see a piece of litter on the ground and you stop to pick it up and put it in the garbage with a whole lot of other people past that and didn't do that. So and then just like, and letting yourself just realize that that's enough, that these small positive acts of good, we're given these moral quandaries all the time. We don't see them, but if we were to really open up to them and see them and notice how many opportunities we have in a day to make a moral choice. And if we choose right, how powerful that is and how that is really, that's meaning making and that's life changing, but not in a way that's ever going to get any awards or, you know, compliments even. I think that's so important. And these are the transcendent qualities, the kind of universal truths.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible. I don't know. Let me ask, the expert here is our whole life about neurochemistry. I mean, if we're getting these feel good sensations as we go through our day by picking up the trash that no one else did, rather than looking at our spreadsheets and seeing that there's a missing zero from what we want on our, our business revenues, is that all there is? Is there nothing more than just keeping yourself in that happiness, contentment, satisfaction, rich, meaningful life?
No, I mean, I think, you know, in fact, the opposite. I mean, I think what we have to realize is that our brain is limited in its capacity to see true cause and effect, and even in limited in terms of sensory processing, and that our brain is really evolved for a very different world than we live in now, right? Our brain has really evolved for basic survival. So since we don't have to really worry about basic survival anymore, what are we going to do? We've got to rethink, you know, this process, and we've got to actually start to ignore some of our chemical signals and act counter to some of those signals. In service of higher meaning and purpose, which is actually outside of our brain, I think we probably spend too much time and effort trying to pull meaning from inside of ourselves or from our like brain chemistry.
Our primitive brains.
Right. And instead, what we have to do is really transcend the body and the brain and recognize the serious limitations of these brain signals.
Right. We're smart enough to realize that, but then we drift back into primitive brain when we shouldn't. We should flip-flop it. I love that.
Right. And I think recognizing our vulnerability to these kind of primitive signals is part of the solution, because what we have to realize is that once we're in a situation where we trigger one of these automatic circuits, it's very hard to resist, like the pleasure pain balance. Once you're offered your drug of choice, you know, the craving and desire will be so overwhelming. There's a very rare individual who could actually refuse in that moment. So what we need to do is build kind of a world within a world, so that we're anticipating these triggers and insulating ourselves from the constant temptations by surrounding ourselves with other people who think the way that we do and want to transcend some of these primitive processes, by limiting our access to drugs, by maybe limiting our digital products or what's on our digital products, you know, not having certain things in our home. So I think we have to, you know, a little bit like, you know, Odysseus had hit the sailors tie him to the mast when he heard the siren song, because he knew once he heard the siren song, he would, you know, steer the ship into the rocky shores and they would all perish. So, you know, the sailors, he said, put beeswax in your ears. And he said, tie me to the mast. And that way, you know, when they got heard the siren song and felt the draw, they had already anticipated that in a way that allowed them to get through that channel without and still resist. I think that's the key.
Whew. Yeah, it occurs to me that the more systems and habits that you build into place, I reference my wonderful morning exercise routine all the time, yeah, because it's been life-changing for me, even as a lifelong athlete and a fitness freak who's been deeply immersed in this stuff since I was a little kid. I still didn't have a go-to, you know, exact way that I started my day in a physical fitness effort until, and it's now 5 years, I have a streak going. So perhaps I'm addicted to something this positive, and that could turn into a question, but because I do that for the first 40 minutes of every single day, that means I'm not on my phone. Right. Otherwise, of course, I'm, you know, vulnerable, tempted, all those other things that we all are. So if you're building these models, then you know, by the time it's 2 p.m., I might indulge in a sweeping of the Instagram feed, and maybe I'll even enjoy it, because I haven't had it pollute my life to the extent that I have all those negative feelings.
Right. So exactly. So your morning routine is a great example of self-finding, you know, as well as a little bit pressing on the pain side to get dopamine indirectly. But you figured out that it is these, you know, we emphasize so much like thoughts and emotions, and those are obviously important, but behavior is really important. And behavior can often be the starting place to change thoughts and emotions. So you get up and you immediately do a behavior. You do a physical exercise routine, which serves a bunch of different functions. Number one, it probably, you know, it's a form of hormesis to upregulate your own dopamine transmission, and it'll remain elevated for hours afterwards, as we know exercise can do. But furthermore, it creates a kind of a time function where it delays your first access to your digital device, which is important. Right. It's kind of like intermittent fasting, right? We have to do intermittent fasting with our devices as well, in order to narrow the window in which we're engaged with the devices, which will then limit our consumption. So these are exactly the types of practices. And I always say to my patients, I said, you know, we can talk about the emotions behind this, and we can talk about your thoughts behind this, and all that's important. But what are your practices? What are you actually going to do on any given day that's going to help you be able to get to the end of the day and say, yeah, that was a pretty good day?
Right. So I guess one of the starting points is that awareness, rather than the mindless consumption of digital information or plopping down on the couch, grabbing the remote control, and perhaps creating an addiction to streaming entertainment, because boy, you watch a great show, and I'm famous for, when it comes to my bedtime, I will jump up and go find that thing before the next episode starts. I only have 9 seconds, because I know if that would kick into the next episode, it's going to be tempting to watch, especially if it's Larry David, you know? I mean, you can't stop it. So that awareness is key. And I think we probably have to have those defenses up throughout the entire day, because that we're just getting slammed.
Yes, that's the great insight, right? That we are getting constantly invited to indulge.
Invited. How polite of you to say that.
Yeah, yes. Right. Commandeered is maybe more accurate. And so we have to anticipate that, and we have to put these barriers in place. We have to enlist others to help us and do it together with them. It's much easier to limit ourselves when we're doing it together with other people. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a very complicated, addictogenic world, and we have to anticipate that. And I think it starts with, you know, the awareness, but also the behaviors, right? We have to put the physical barriers in place. Like, you physically jump up and get out of the bed, right? You're not thinking a thought to yourself. You move away from the next episode button so that you can't physically press it. I think we need much more of that kind of these physical barriers and the kind of physical practices. Because again, it's the body is a powerful instrument and we often forget about it.
Is that word addictogenic? Did you make that up? Is that a real word?
I don't know. It could be that I made it up. I have no idea.
I love it. An addictogenic world. So yeah. The term you used in the book about setting these boundaries, categorical self-binding, can you describe that further as we strive to escape from the age of indulgence?
Yeah. So this is where we, within a given category, let's say video games, we recognize that there are certain video games that once we start playing, we just can't stop. So then after a period of abstinence from video games to reset reward pathways, which is what I do with my patients who come in with video game addiction, as we're talking specifically about how to reintegrate video games back into their lives. And the specificity is really important here. It's not a sort of vague, well, I'm going to go back to using, but I'm going to use less. It's like, no, when are you going to use? What are you going to use? And the what are you going to use is the categorical self-binding, like which video games do you feel like you need to avoid altogether and which are the ones you feel like you can play in some moderation. And that extends out to other things. So for example, for me, I mean, I talk about my romance reading. I mean, I've been a reader all my life, but I kind of got addicted to this certain genre. And so in general, I avoid that genre of novel. And I read a lot of mysteries and I read a lot of nonfiction and other things, but I try not to read romance novels. Of course, now when I go and I do read a romance novel, it doesn't do anything for me. So that's the irony too, that eventually what happens in the cycle of addiction is the drug just stops working for us. Like we have this kind of euphoric recall of what it was like, but then when we try to recreate that feeling, we don't get that anymore. And that's again, because of this neuroadaptation, which is probably on some level permanent. Although you can reset reward pathways, those gremlins once created never entirely go away. And they're always kind of waiting in the wings to hop back on, which is certainly, you know, what my patients also describe with alcohol and cannabis and other more typical drugs.
Yeah, I suppose that's highly adaptive because you think about the extreme thrill seeker who needs a higher high. And so they jump off the building with the parachute and now right. That's not good enough. So they have to jump off the, the airplane and land on the building and so forth. Right. That could get you in trouble.
Yeah. And that's called tolerance, needing more and more of our drug or more potent forms over time to get the same effect, or finding that our drug stops working for us at a given dose or even turns on us. Yeah. And tolerance is, sometimes if we abstain for a period of time, we can recapture tolerance, but sometimes for people, tolerance is actually, permanent and they can't kind of especially as we age, sort of recapture, that joy, which is, hard, but it is what it is.
Yeah. I think it's all right.
Yeah.
Not a lot of it's really redeeming when you think about it. If you get too far deep into anything, and I'm familiar with the extreme exercise, pursuit of the endorphin like chemicals that come into play after especially a strenuous workout, then you find yourself pushing yourself harder and harder, and then throw in the numbers that you mentioned earlier. So if you become competitive and want to beat your time and feel a greater hormonal bathing in feel good hormones after, pretty soon you crash, and then as you described, the baseline level of dopamine and other things are below normal, and then you experience depression, anxiety. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. So ultimately, with repeated exposure to that reinforcing drug or behavior, what happens is that initial response gets weaker and shorter. That's tolerance. But that after response to the pain side gets longer and stronger. We essentially go into this chronic dopamine deficit state. And that feels exactly like depression, anxiety, insomnia. So in fact, when we get to that place, what we need to do to reestablish a healthy hedonic level of dopamine firing is actually abstain from that drug for long enough to sort of trick the brain into kind of resetting those baseline dopamine levels.
Right. I remember you saying, not 2 weeks, people. You need 30 days. Yeah. Is 30 days the magic number?
No, I've been doing this for about two decades, and it's amazing how consistently 30 days is the magic number. That 2 days, 2 weeks is almost universally, people are still in withdrawal. It's really only in weeks 3 and 4 that they start to come out of it. So if people don't abstain, people will say, well, I abstained and it didn't make any difference. I'm like, well, how long did you abstain? It was a week or it was 2 weeks. I'm saying, yeah, that's not long enough. You need to really go longer. And in fact, although 30 days is the average time, you know, for the brain to begin to reap the rewards of the dopamine fast, abstaining for longer than that is really what it takes to really fully heal the brain, you know, and really get it. So for people, for example, with like alcohol addiction, like they feel a lot better at 30 days, but if they can go 3 months or 6 months, those gains are just increased even beyond that.
And would this be applicable to anything that one could consider a adverse addiction?
What do you mean by that?
I mean, is it applied to mobile device use, substance abuse, overeating, whatever the category is, overexercising?
Yeah. So, you know, what we call addiction to a behavior, a process addiction or a behavioral addiction, as opposed to a substance use disorder. But what I find so fascinating is that the natural history of the progression to addiction is exactly the same, whether you're dealing with a drug that you ingest or whether you're dealing with a behavior like gambling, pornography, video games, social media. People usually start out for one of two reasons: to have fun or to solve a problem. If it works for them, then they'll go back to that substance repeatedly. And if they get to progress to regular daily use, they'll eventually build up tolerance, or they need more and more of the drug to get the same effect. They'll start to increase their quantity, put more and more effort and energy and time and money into getting that drug, using the drug. And eventually, if they're, you know, prone to addiction to that drug, then they'll start to sacrifice all kinds of resources. And they'll start to experience all kinds of problems. And yet even those problems are not enough to deter them from the pursuit of that their drug. And really, that's kind of the heart of addiction. It's the continued use despite consequences. Now, many of us will go a part of the way down that path and then go, wait a minute, you know, this isn't working out. And we'll be able to recalibrate. And that means that we probably don't have vulnerability to addiction to that particular substance or behavior. But people with that vulnerability to addiction, they can get to that point and they can either not see the consequences, or even if they see the consequences, they can't stop, right? They continue with this relentless pursuit. And that's really, you know, the hallmark of addiction, like this loss of agency, even in the face of severe consequences.
And are there genetic vulnerabilities? And if they are, do they go across the board? We know so much about the contention that alcoholism has a genetic component, a strong genetic component, I suppose. Is that person also vulnerable to the mobile device more so than someone else, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So it gets to this concept of drug of choice. You know, what tilts your balance to the side of pleasure may not tilt mine, and vice versa. And then there are certainly people who seem to be vulnerable to addiction to just about anything. And that's probably partially inherited. But it's also true that once you've been addicted to something, had a severe addiction, you kind of prime the brain for addiction, and then you're vulnerable to cross addiction. There's lots of hope. People with severe addictions to lots of different substances and behaviors get into really robust and wonderful recovery. So it's not that we have to despair, but it is true that, you know, an addiction probably permanently changes the brain, making us more vulnerable to future addictions.
Well, I guess the high dopamine-seeking attribute is in so many ways positive. It was evolutionary driving, survival driving, and now we just have to temper it with some increased awareness of all the vulnerabilities we have in the shortcut life.
Yeah, so that's really the key. I mean, you know, I think many forms of mental illness are sort of traits that are endemic in the population that in a given ecosystem are either advantageous or disadvantageous. But because the ecosystem changes enough, our genetics are wise enough to keep those genes around in case something catastrophic changes the environment, right? So if you think about people who are severely addicted, basically what they are is tenacious strivers who aren't going to give up when everybody else does. And again, in an apocalyptic world, let's say, you know, where we're having to go back to sort of subsistence survival, I bet people with genetic vulnerability for addiction are going to be the people who are going to be the most valuable members of the tribe, you know, because they don't give up
Right. Bruce Willis did okay in Die Hard. In fact, he came back Die Hard five times or something. He just wouldn't give up. how is radical honesty involved in this story?
Well, radical honesty is something that I learned about from my patients. What I discovered is that patients in the most robust and sustained recovery from severe addictions were people who had concluded that they couldn't lie about anything. So not lie about their drug use, but also not lie about small things in everyday life. And it turns out that the average human tells 1 to 2 lies per day. So we're all natural liars. We do it reflexively. We're usually lying to cover up small transgressions or trying to make ourselves look better, smarter, faster, more wonderful than we are. But what's happening when we commit to not lying, even about small things, is that we're probably activating the prefrontal cortex, which is the storytelling part of our brain, which is really fundamental to creating our autobiographical lived narratives, which become not just a way to organize the past, but also provide a roadmap for the future. What I find in my practice is that people who tell true stories about themselves are the people who are going to most likely be able to have access to the information they need going forward to make good decisions. Whereas people who are telling narratives that are not, you know, adhering to the truth are people who are deep in their addiction and are not going to make progress. Mm. And as people move from addiction into recovery, the narratives change. It's really fascinating. And they go from these narratives that are often self-deluding into these narratives that are much more realistic, you know, along the lines of, well, yes, this happened to me, but on the other hand, this is what I contributed to the problem.
Mm. So that must be fascinating to sit there and watch the arc of the character.
It is.
If it's a patient. Yeah. And I guess you got to bite your tongue initially because it has to be on their own time. I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, what's really interesting is that when people are using their drug and in their addiction, they really can't see true cause and effect, not just around their addiction, but in general in the world. And they can present very personality disordered. But when they stop using and they get into recovery and they reset reward pathways, oftentimes those kind of personality looking traits disappear, and then they're able to really, you know, engage their frontal lobe and sort of, you know, process information, say, oh, wait a minute, you know, this relates to this, relates to this. And so you get a more coherent narrative, you get a more logical narrative, you get a more truthful narrative that really is able to see, you know, true cause and effect, because that's what our brains are. We're always telling stories in an effort to understand true cause and effect so that we can make better decisions going forward. But when we're in an addiction, we can't tell truthful stories because we can't see true cause and effect because we're really focused on just getting more dopamine. It becomes a physiologic overriding mechanism that just shuts down all of our other systems.
And you're saying this extends beyond the issue at hand. So the person who's drinking too much and you intervene and call them on it, not only are they going to be in denial about that, but they're also going to be kind of clouded in how their career might be harmed by their drinking and so forth.
Oh yeah. Or even just in terms of the way they conceptualize the future, there's a wonderful experiment where healthy controls were asked to finish the statement like, in the future, I see myself. And for healthy control subjects, usually they ended up narrating something that had to do with, you know, a decade hence. People who were deep in their addiction, they answered the question, in the future, I see myself. And they would talk about like a week from now, right? Because the addicted brain is a brain that's mired in immediate short-term rewards. We're not even able to project ourselves into the future. And so it's really physiologic.
Oof. What a lot to think about and strive to increase our awareness. I thank you so much for these great insights and the great book, Dopamine Nation. I also want to know, how do you do it, Dr. Anna? You're seeing patients, you're in clinical practice, you're teaching at Stanford, you're writing these sensational best-selling books, and you're striving to, you know, not get sucked into the numbers game and the dopaminergic lifestyle.
Well, you know, on the surface of it, and when you say it like that, it sounds like a lot. But, you know, actually, I spend a lot of time kind of managing my mental health by slowing my life down, taking the time for exercise and quiet reflection, time with family and friends, really focusing on process, trying to take it a day at a time, trying to be truthful and do small acts through a day and not kind of future, let's say, catastrophize one way or another. I mean, I struggle just like everybody else, but I have learned to narrow it down to the window of just trying to have a series of good days as I understand them.
Right. And I would speculate it probably hasn't held you back from tangible material success and accomplishment to keep those efforts in place and take the time for a hike rather than another hour at the screen or what have you.
Yeah. In fact, I would say if you look at the trajectory of my life, it was only when I began doing that, you know, sort of seeking to live a life that prioritized the deeper meanings that oddly, some of these professional accomplishments sort of started. It was as if, you know, it was only when I stopped striving for those things that those things came.
Imagine so, that, people. Yeah, what a great example.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. How do we connect with you further?
Well, I'm not on social media. But,
imagine that too. Okay. You got to go get the book then and have an actual an in-depth experience.
There you go.
Okay, go look for Dopamine Nation. That's a sign reading for all listeners. Thank you so much, Dr. Anna Lemke. Great show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Da-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum.
It's time to talk about another great supplement from Bioptimizers. Now, we've all heard about the awesome benefits of probiotics and probiotic-rich foods for digestive health and gut health, but probiotics are also beneficial for mental clarity and focus and overall energy levels. Yes, the gut-brain connection is real, people, and many experts agree that this is the most exciting emerging field of medicine today. Along with making my own kombucha and eating probiotic-rich foods, I take the fantastic supplement from Bioptimizers called P3OM. P3OM is a patented probiotic strain that increases mental clarity and focus and overall energy throughout the day. And unlike coffee, it doesn't keep you up at night. It actually improves your sleep and recovery so you can kick ass again the next day. And energy isn't the only benefit that P3OM offers. P3OM can enhance weight loss and help you gain lean muscle. It's all about getting your digestive system more efficient at processing nutrients from your food. P3OM is called the, quote, Navy SEAL by researchers due to its ability to kill bad bacteria. You can even see a video of P3OM breaking down food at this link, p3om.com/Brad. And at that same link, p3om.com/Brad, you can get 10% off by typing in the coupon Brad or shopping from that page. And if you order anything from Bioptimizers, and it's not everything that you hoped for, you have their best-in-class guarantee or your money back. Just visit p3om.com/Brad to get the 10% discount, p3om.com/Brad, and try this wonderful supplement.
Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.